with Heidi Roizen, who's a legend in Silicon Valley. She's one of those very, very few women entrepreneurs who have also been a successful venture capitalist. So it's Heidi has worn many hats, definitely as an entrepreneur and as a venture capitalist. She has seen the world, the Silicon Valley world, from a very unique perspective, and we are honored to have her as our guest today. Heidi, welcome. It's terrific to have you here.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here and a pleasure to be able to talk with you.
So we have been living in a world of unicorn mania for a little while. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all of you who are listening to this conversation, if you have been following the material that we have been publishing from 1 million by 1 million, we have tried to put some perspective on this issue. There are good sides to the unicorn mania. There are bad sides to the unicorn mania. And a few months ago, Heidi, you did a fabulous piece of journalism highlighting one of those bad sides of the unicorn mania. And I want to start there, and we'll go where we need to go from there. But let's start with one particular piece that you wrote, which I thought was very well analyzed. And the piece was titled, How to Build a Unicorn from Scratch and Walk Away with Nothing. Well, how do you do that?
Well, you know, this is the thing that has, you know, I've been in doing this for a long time, and I've seen cycles come and go. And I think there are two things every entrepreneur should be aware of that they really aren't aware of. One is that not everything goes well all the time. If you're an entrepreneur, you absolutely fully believe that everything's going to go great for you. And yet the reality is that is not always, it's almost never the case. The second thing is that our economy moves in cycles, and the macroeconomic conditions will affect your ability to raise money and prosper, again, yeah, for almost every company. So if you take those two things in mind, what has happened and what created this sort of unicorn problem, I would say, is that entrepreneurs got very fixated on raising large amounts of money at high valuations because, first of all, money in the war chest seems like a good thing to have, and second of all, being able to talk about your billion-dollar valuation, you know, makes it feel like, oh, I can, you know, I can tell my employees and everybody feels like this is a really solid company and all of that. But there's a falseness under that because at the end of the day, venture capital is still debt. It is money you have to pay back in pretty much every circumstance, right? It's preferred shares, and preferred shares, in essence, are debt that must be paid back first in any but a terrible outcome or an IPO where everything goes to common. But we can count the number of IPOs in the last year on not too many toes and fingers, so let's not go that direction. So the reality is the entrepreneurs have made this sort of deal with the devil. I guess I shouldn't say that because that makes it sound like the investors are devils, but the entrepreneur says, I want a really high valuation and I want to raise a bunch of money because I raise a bunch of money at a high valuation, I don't get diluted. And the investor says, okay, well, but I want some downside protection because it's hard for me to imagine your company is worth $1 billion today, so I tell you what I'll do. I'm going to put in preferred, liquidation preferences, ratchets, anti-dilution. They put in a bunch of terms that literally I've heard entrepreneurs say, well, there's a bunch of terms on the term sheet. Let's not worry about that. And the reality is entrepreneurs need to worry about that because the terms are more important than the valuation, right? And so let me use an extreme example. Here's a fun example. I went to a party once and I said, I will make anyone a unicorn tonight. I will give anyone $1 billion valuation. And I had a term sheet and it was printed on my business card. And it said, here are the terms. I'm going to invest $1 in you. I want 100x on my money. And I'll give you $1 billion valuation, right? So we had a funny joke that night. It's like everyone, I gave about a bunch of dollars with this card, and then everyone could say, I just got funded for $1 billion valuation, yeah, right? But the reality is, well, that's not a very good deal for you. Now, admittedly, it was only $1, but if you have to pay me $100 as return on my money, that's not a very good deal for you. Luckily, it was just $1, so it was kind of fun. But the reality is, again, if you're raising 50, 100, 200 million and there are ratchets and there are these kind of onerous terms and there are multiples guaranteed and there are all sorts of things on that money, you and your investor are in a very different place. Right, and this is, you know, the end of this story, this is why it's taking me so long to answer the question. Is it's actually very complicated, particularly
yes,
when there
is.
Are multiple rounds of financing, and everybody around the table starts to have different economics. Right, you have one person who, if your company sells for $1 billion versus a half a billion versus a quarter billion, they're still going to get double their money, and then you have another person who doesn't make a penny until after you sell for $1 billion, for example. Those people are going to have very different economics. And, you know, the one thing entrepreneurs should remember is, unless you are in a highly unusual situation, you sit at the bottom of the stack. You sit below everyone else who has invested money on whatever terms in your company. And so I just think entrepreneurs need to keep that in mind, and I really believe that clean and simple terms at rational valuations are the best healthy hygiene for any normal company that is out there to raise money.
Yeah, and also, you know, so the subtext of all the things that you're saying is that there aren't that many billion-dollar exits.
No,
you know, ultimately,
aren't.
The only valuation that matters is your exit valuation, and if you've got a billion-dollar valuation in a private round, let's say a Series B or a Series C round, you get a billion-dollar valuation, and then you exit for $200 million. What's that?
That's right. I mean,
going to do for you?
This is the thing that is a little troubling to me, is we have really redefined success currently. Well, now it's coming back. It's rationalizing again.
Yeah.
But believe me, you know, if your goal is, I'm going to sell my company for $1 billion, or I'm going to create a billion-dollar company, or I'm a worthless human being, you've really set yourself up in a very difficult circumstance if you just look at the math, right? And if you really want to, and again, this goes back, this actually speaks to the entrepreneur's fundamental motivation. Do you want to change the world with what you're doing, or do you want to ultimately make some money? Most entrepreneurs, I think, will say, yes, I want to do both. I want to do something meaningful. I want to change the world. But at the end of the day, I'd like to walk away with some wealth creation for myself for having done so. Most
Absolutely.
Companies, again, sell for sub 100 million. Some successful companies sell for sub 300. And even when you get above 300 million, you are talking about a fairly rarefied atmosphere. So I really encourage entrepreneurs every step of the way when you're raising money, to run what I call is a waterfall chart. And a waterfall chart is a spreadsheet that shows in various outcomes, what do each of the stakeholders make, right? What do I make? What do my employees make? What do my angel investors make? What does this current new money make? And you cannot discern that just looking at a capitalization table, because again, these terms are very complicated. And so I would really encourage every entrepreneur, before you take money, to say, well, if I take this $10 million of financing, or even this $1 million of financing, or as I pointed out, even this dollar of financing, let's run a spreadsheet and say, if my company is worth $5 million, what will I make? If my company is worth $50 million, what will I make? If my company is worth, you know, run your edge cases and understand what you're getting into, because at least then you are knowingly going into that next fundraising, understanding that you've just raised the bar for your exit in terms of the return to yourself and your earliest investors.
Yeah. There are a couple of points that come to my mind as I'm listening to you, is that, you know, we work with these highly sophisticated technology gurus, right? So everybody
right.
is a technology guru in some domain or the other, and these supposedly genius people don't understand probability.
No.
What
they don't understand probability. They don't understand simple math. I mean, I joke with, I teach at Stanford, and I teach in the engineering school, and I joke with the engineers because I say, you know, I teach here in the engineering school, and yet I am a creative writing major undergrad, right? I don't have a technical degree. But there are a few things about math I can tell you that I know that it's amazing to me that on engineers, you know, who can do this amazing calculus and everything, you know, I'll say things like, for example, there is only ever 100%. You can't make more of 100%. You can make 100% worth more, But at any, it, on every, in every company I know, the cap table adds up to 100%. Therefore, yeah, the idea that you're going to pay somebody a percent and you're going to pay someone else a percent, and then every time you raise money, those people need to be made whole back to their percent, that is ultimately impossible math, right? So that's one of those pieces of impossible math. The next thing is this idea that all companies are ultimately valued, and people will argue with me about this. Ultimately, companies are valued at the net present value of their future cash flows, right? That's a fancy business school thing, right? But at the end of the day, a company that never makes money is ultimately not going to be of value. Now, why do people buy companies that don't make money? Because they presume they can bring them into their parent company and ultimately, guess what, make money, either on that technology per se or using that technology to enable other revenue streams. So this is another thing that I sort of, you know, there are some simple things, right? And another simple thing, I think, I see this all the time. I literally have this genius engineer who will say, well, I have two job offers, and one of them is at this company and one of them is at that company, but these guys only offered me 10,000 shares, and these guys offered me 100,000 shares. I'm like, well, that's meaningless. Do you know what the shares are worth? Do you know what the overhang is, i.e. how much debt and venture is sitting on top of the common? Do you know what the terms are about the buyback? You know, again, even as an employee going to an entrepreneurial company, you need to understand, because the face value of this, of these shares is in itself a meaningless piece of data. It's like having an equation that is insolvable because you just don't have sufficient data to actually understand.
And the sad thing is, when you're going for job interviews and negotiating job packages, the companies will not tell you all this details of how much preference
so
there
is.
And
this is fascinating to me. And by the way, I now have to say the disclaimer. I am not currently representing the views of DFJ, the venture capital firm, or my partners. This is just Heidi talking out of line. But my own opinion about this, I just had an argument with somebody yesterday about this. I said, I believe that companies should be transparent about that.
Yes,
I believe
I agree
that
with
actually
that.
When you get hired, someone should sit you down, particularly because your equity package in a startup is a meaningful part of your future plan, right? And
yes,
and I think someone should realistically say to you, this could go to zero. Here's the overhang sitting over you. Here's, you know, again, a waterfall chart, not down to the individual person. I don't necessarily believe that everyone should know what pieces everyone else holds, but collectively as a class, I think that anyone coming into a company should actually understand what it takes for their shares to be worth something. And there are certain companies in the Valley for which this is highly transparent. There have been some companies that have said, we're willing to be open about this. And there are other companies that obfuscate this and actually think it's sort of criminal when you disclose this to employees. How dare you tell employees that there's $90 million of preferences ahead of you or something? I just think this is kind of crazy stuff. And you know, I mean, to me, when you're an entrepreneur or an employee and you're going to invest years of your life into something, you should understand what the payout likelihoods are. Now, that said, I think most people grossly overestimate the probability, as you put it, of their payout, right? And I think this is also a disease here in the Valley. Okay, now I'm on my soapbox. But the other thing is, just because you work for a startup for 4 years doesn't mean you should become a millionaire. I mean, this is, again, the reality of the reality of reality is that outsized rewards for sort of regular work, you could be a really hard worker, you could be doing a great job, but why does that entitle you to be fabulously wealthy from having done so? I still think that there is a huge element of luck and timing to which companies actually succeed. And so the flip side of saying to any employee or entrepreneur, you should understand what your equity package might do, the flip side is to say to them also, you should also realize that that's a little bit like buying a lottery ticket, and you should be at peace with whatever your regular compensation package is. And if you're willing to trade ordinary income for this upside in additional equity, you know, more power to you, but recognize the probabilities, right? Because I think there is a lot of survivor bias in the Valley and a lot of this sense of, you know, I tell my students, well, that's why they publicize the people who win the lottery, because it's, you can, identify with that person who wins the lottery, but guess what? You're not going to win the lottery, actually, according to, you know, statistics. So I just think people need to be informed.
So to summarize, what are the top terms that people should be watching for and fully understanding?
Well, the simplest term is preferred, right? And mm-hmm. you know, again, it's such beautiful language, right? There are preferred shares and there are common shares, right? Which would you rather be? You know, I'd rather be preferred. Preferred is pretty much the industry standard, right? If I'm going to invest money in your company, my stock is preferred, which means I'm going to get my money out first, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the first term. Participating is another one, and, you know, whether or not that's industry standard, it's just the idea that once I get my money out, is everyone else made kind of more whole first, or now did I get my money out, but I still have all the same rights as everyone else, right? So do I get to participate in the proceeds, or do I have to wait around until everybody's sort of evened up? You know, and again, I'm giving you very vague, these are first grade interpretation. You should, any entrepreneur who's doing this kind of stuff, if they can, they should get a lawyer who does this. Don't use your Uncle Joe, who's a divorce attorney or whatever. There's a very specific language and terms to early stage investing. There's a fabulous book by Brad Feld and Jason Mendelsohn called Venture Deals. Everyone should read that. If you're going to sell pieces of your company, take 2 days to read a book and understand. This is another pet peeve of mine, is entrepreneurs who absolutely want to control every single thing about their product and their company, but then they don't even know what these terms mean, right? You're going to live and die by these terms, so you better know them. So I think that's a great book. The other big one, and this happens in multiple rounds of financing, but this is, you know, to me, this is a critical thing to understand, is stacked preferences versus pari passu preference. Pari passu meaning everyone is the same, right? In a stacked preference, think of it as a wedding cake, although an inverted wedding cake, because usually more money comes in every subsequent round, right? If I'm going to eat that wedding cake, i.e. if we're going to have a liquidity event, I'm going to start eating at the top and move to the bottom. So the people at the top get to eat every piece of that wedding cake before the next layer gets to have a bite, right? As mm-hmm. opposed to pari passu means in a liquidity event, we're going to slice that cake like this, and everybody's going to get a piece of that. And again, I'm using a kind of a vague, you know, go do your homework on this. But the point is, when you have stack preferences, and this money usually comes in at different valuations, what you've created is a situation where every person has a very different financial incentive, right? The people at the top are going to make their money no matter what, as long as you sell for a certain amount. The people at the bottom are not going to make anything until you eat that entire cake. Pari passu, when every subsequent round, they may come in paying a different price, right? Their shares may have been more expensive, but ultimately the liquidity is going to flow sort of more equally to everyone, which is a much better construct if you can get it. And again, it's a negotiation. A lot of times you say, well, why doesn't everyone do it this way? Well, I'll tell you why, because if I'm the last money coming in and you kind of have made, not necessarily made a lot of progress, you raised, you know, I say to some people, I say, you know what? The good news is you've built a nice little $10 million company. The bad news is you burned through $50 million to do it, right? If that's you and I'm the next money in that's going to help you get to profitability, I don't want pari passu, right? I'm going to say, well, what the hell, those other people, you kind of wasted their money. I don't care if they get their money back or not. I'm going to give you more money, but it sits on top of everything else. So, again, these terms were all invented, generally speaking, for reasons of downside protection for the investors, right? And that is the reality, right? It's a negotiation. It's downside protection for the investors versus it's as entrepreneurially friendly as it can be for the entrepreneur who's negotiating the other side. So the point being, just understand these terms and understand how they impact not only what your return is, but the motivations of everyone else around the table, right? Because when you set up a situation where someone's sitting there and they're going to make three times their money no matter what and they're going to be the first money out, and then another person is sitting at the table and they're only going to make money if you sell this company for $200 million, you are talking about two people who are going to have dramatically different ideas about strategically what you should do in your company. And that, to me, is a very divisive thing. That's what I, as an entrepreneur, and again, remember, I was I've been a VC now for, oh, I don't even want to think about it, 16 years. But I was an entrepreneur for 14 years before that, and I raised two rounds of venture. And so I've lived this as an entrepreneur, and I've lived this as a venture capitalist. And I would tell you that even though I understand why VCs negotiate for these terms, and I myself at DFJ have negotiated for these terms, right? Participating preferred, stack preferences, multiples on exit. Trust me, I'm quite happy to do that because that's the business we're in, is to try to return money to our limited partners. But at the end of the day, when you do these things and when you trade a high valuation for this other stuff, you're going to create a divisive underlying shareholder base, and that is going to come around usually to hurt you unless everything goes super well. And pretty much in my history, I think I've been on about 40 boards in my life so far. Very rarely does everything go perfectly, right? I mean, it's just very rarely does it ever go perfectly.
And I think that's kind of the problem with this unicorn thing of raising too much money, is that one, you're working a very, very low, you're betting on a very low probability scenario for success.
Right.
And two, you're introducing levels of complication that you yourself have a hard time understanding, let alone other people understanding.
Right. Absolutely.
So complexity, actually, you know, I think successful entrepreneurship or successful anything actually, is not taking uncalculated risks. Calculated risks are good. And actually, success comes from mitigating risks that you don't have a lot of control over. So the truth is, you're working in the probability scenario that you're working with is the higher number of success, the higher probability of success is in the $100 million exit scenario, which means that you have to do a company without burning more than $20 million, $25 million to
That's
be
right.
able to make any money at all,
and
you know, any
way,
reasonable
I
amount of money.
Even $100 million success
is a low probability
really
scenario.
Unlikely. I mean, this is another thing I've explained, again, to entrepreneurs. I say even at the small ranges, you know, if you raise $2, $3, $4 million, right, and you have mm-hmm. simple terms and it's a reasonable valuation, whatever, even if you sell your company for $20, $25 million, that is a life-changing experience usually for
yes.
the couple entrepreneurs at the founding level. For most people, if you walk away with $5 million, $5 million is a lot of money. You know, even in Silicon Valley, you can, you know, buy a condo for $5 million. No, I'm joking. But, I mean, $5 million, again, most people don't, you know, just process that for a minute. $5 million is a life-changing amount of money for most people.
Yeah.
If you have raised $15 or $20 million and you sell your company for $25 million,
you don't make anything.
Right? And so when people do this where they raise a bunch of money and they say, well, it's my safety net. It's my safety net to make mistakes. But then they create this sort of, you know, this debt that needs to be repaid. They also create a barrier to new people putting money in because they look and they say, well, those guys expect to get their money back. And I worry more about the people at the bottom of the stack because those are the employees. You know, you just create these structures that don't work. And I'd argue, why do that? And I understand because entrepreneurs will say, well, I need the money. And I also will put a disclaimer in here. There are certain types of companies. And by the way, I say this in part because DFJ has a history of investing in some of these companies
yes.
that are disruptive. They're capital intensive. Some of them take hundreds of millions of dollars of investment before you get to the first customer. Right? I mean, SpaceX. Like, you can imagine if in the downturn, you don't sit around at SpaceX and go, well, let's cut to profitability. You know, instead of building rockets that are going to, you know, go into the space orbit, why don't we just try to get to, you know, Lodi with something? You know, that doesn't work, right? There are just certain types of capital-intensive businesses. Tesla, another one, right? You're not going to build those. Sometimes you have to take a leap of faith and raise lots of money on a big-ass thing. But for most companies, right, most of the companies I see that are trying to, kind of bring an evolution of something to a service business or whatever, actually you could, you know, and I'll say this, is even as a venture capitalist, my favorite form of financing is customers buying your product, right?
That's
because
right.
it's validating, it's
Absolutely.
Non-dilutive. And so if you, as an early stage startup, can figure out how to get somebody to pay you for what you're doing, that is golden. That is the best, absolutely the best money that you can use to build your business. And I just would encourage entrepreneurs to really think about that, as opposed to going and raising funding, to really think about, can you get your business started by someone who's going to value what you do and is going to pay you for doing it without taking that equity dilution?
This is the mantra in 1 million by 1 million. You know, our definition of entrepreneurship equals customers, revenues, and profits. Financing and exit are optional.
That's
so
right.
So you just underscored exactly that. Heidi, one point you made, which I think is an excellent point and is a perfect kind of summary of what you discussed today. Investors are portfolio managers. You are not.
Yeah.
Could you elaborate?
Sure. I think this is the thing is, you know, like currently at DFJ, I'm responsible for 8 companies, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's 8 companies that I am a board director and a board observer. And believe me, I try as hard as I can for those companies. I show up, I'm responsive, but I have 8, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm making decisions even among those 8, and again, in the broader DFJ portfolio of 100, if we subsequently, you know, especially in a fund that's closed, right, a fund that is no longer making new investments, no longer having new capital come in,
mm-hmm.
$1 million into one company is $1 million that's not going into another company, right? And so we're portfolio managers. We're looking across the field and we're saying, who's got the best chance of returning this money? Who might need a bit of a save? Who do we just feel isn't going to make the cut? And yet you as the entrepreneur, 100% of your eggs are in that one basket. And so I just think it's important to remember that your outcome matters to you more than your outcome matters to your investor usually, who has multiple bets, right, and who is going to be judged by their performance across the whole portfolio, not just across your deal. So again, I like to believe that, you know, emotionally, spiritually, whatever, as the friend of the entrepreneur, I show up and I work as hard as I can. But then in the background, I also have, I and my partners have 100 companies, each of whom sit in a fund, each of which has limited funding, and we have to make decisions between who gets the limited remaining resources. And,
yeah.
You know, we're portfolio managers at the end of the day.
Heidi, this has been fantastic. You have given a lot of pointers, and like you said, folks, do your homework. She's given you pointers. She's given you the framework of what to study. We've got to study. And this is what we do here is that we give people frameworks and structures and philosophies and you know, ideas that, but they need to study. I'm looking for rigor, guys. You know, this is technology business. You guys are supposed to be geniuses. Work hard, do the homework, and then make decisions. Don't make these off-the-cuff stupid decisions driven by media hype. It's stupid, and don't be stupid. That's the end of the story, right?
Don't be stupid. Is that the new mantra? Don't be stupid.
Well,
you know, I love what you're doing, and I'm a huge fan. So this has been great.
We'll talk soon.
All righty.
We'll talk
Thanks.
Again soon. Thank
okay.
you. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for coming.